Facade of the American Dream.
I think we are in a desperately difficult period of oppression in communities of color.
See, mass black incarceration, which we can date to around the year 1970 as a national policy, mass black incarceration as the general white reaction and response to our movement of the 60s. It is as if the general response of the white population to black demand for human rights was to say, okay, you guys won't stay in your place, the place we designated for you under Jim Crow. All right, we have a place for you, and that place is prison.
When we talk about mass incarceration, part of the mechanism for feeding the prison system comes from the stop and frisk, and then comes from the so-called war on drugs that was initiated by earlier administrations and continues to be carried through from the federal to the state to the city level by the current administrations.
Crime in the African American community can be directly associated with where society has more or less delegated where we should be on the totem pole.
The structural violence which has been perpetrated against African Americans. So if you think about the social inequalities across the board which affect African Americans and the institutional racism which affects African Americans.
All of a sudden in the 80s, the latter part of the 70s and 80s, they had that big dump of drugs and our illegal drugs, cocaine, heroin, other things that we didn't manufacture that were brought into our community. It's almost like it brought us to a halt.
Dating to about 1970, this exponential growth of the prison population and the growth in the proportion of prison inmates who were black. In the mid-60s, the U.S. prison population was about 70% white. Today, that has been reversed. It's only about 30% white. So we understand that not only has the prison population increased 8 or 9-fold since 1970, but that increase has meant that black folks and brown folks are now the dominant groups in the prison.
And from the 1980s until today, we're still struggling with that. It's not at the same level, but we're still struggling with how that affected our family 2 and 3 generations, the African American community 2 and 3 generations later. They're looking at us. They're not watching them.
The number and the presumption there was to unearth gun trafficking and gun use and gun carrying. There's less than 1% of the people that were stopped and frisked that were ever found to have any firearms on them. So the statistics bear proof that it is, while we are told that this is a public safety issue, nonsense. There's nothing that bears that out.
I think it's definitely systemic because these things are not happening on an individual basis. We've had black professors on this campus being profiled and arrested by the police after they've been working here for years, and we see the same things happening all across the country.
When I first moved here to Atlanta, I would regularly get pulled over by the police. I had an older Nissan, and I lived in a more affluent area, and I would regularly get pulled over. One day I got a ticket because part of my tag was ripped off. I went to court because I was thinking, oh, this makes no sense. They can look it up and tell that my car is registered and that my insurance is in place and all the other things. And the bailiff told me, he said, you know what, you need to go to the police station and talk to them and let them know that you're new in the area, that you now live here.
Three white kids can drive in a car, four and five of them, no problem. They think it's a happy time. But for us, it's something suspect.
Where you are most likely to be incarcerated are places like Wisconsin, Nebraska, and Idaho, where it appears that the incarceration rates for blacks are highest because the cops have to keep on going back to those same inner city neighborhoods to get the same black people in order to satisfy the demand to lock more black people up in jail.
I was a little bit younger. I used to be stopped all the time in the airport. And so I would plan on just an extra half an hour because I knew I was going to get a pat down search. That was before they put everything in place. You know, now I always make sure that I carry my medical license on me. I usually always make sure that there's a white coat or something in my car that if I'm pulled over by the police or something, which still happens, I can use that information to at least try to open up a window so that I don't have to potentially address some issues that aren't relevant.
Mechanisms of social control are virtually terrorizing and criminalizing our youth in particular.
African Americans in the system of mass incarceration is the most pressing issue of the 21st century, primarily because any African American male born after the year 2001, one out of three can be expected to serve time in a federal or state prison. We've had an explosion of over 400% of women since the 1980s, black women who have been incarcerated, which has disrupted our communities, which has broken up our families, and which has led to the social disorganization of our African-American communities across the United States.
50%, and now it's the black 50%, of people in Washington, D.C. are either on parole, on probation, or in prison.
America has the biggest prison population, not only today, but in the history of humankind, you know, in the whole history of man's tenure on this planet, you know. And what does it say about America? It says that something is very wrong. Huh? Any nation that locks up and puts human beings in cages for 10, 20, 30 years, you know, and considers it normal, there's something wrong.
We lead the world in terms of the rate of incarceration. Nobody's crying out about how can you, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, have the highest incarceration rate in the world. So we always point out and we look at all these little despotic countries and say, you got to watch out for human rights violations. We got to deal with you because you got human rights violation. And here we go, taking all of these young black men and now rapidly growing women and putting them in jailhouse.
In 1970, there was 300,000 prisoners in the entire United States. You know, and today we got 2.4 million in cages, another 5 million under the control of the criminal justice system, virtually on leashes. We've become an incarceration nation.
The profit behind making money on the backs of incarcerating young black men. We have a billion-dollar prison-for-profit industry in the United States, where we have now prisons which are on the stock market. We have the Correctional Corporation of America. We have the GEO Group. So on any given day, you can buy stock in a prison, and based on where we're going right now, you would probably get a pretty good profit.
It gets even more insidious because now prisons are privately run corporations. And in order to make money as a privately run corporation that runs a jailhouse is that you got to make sure that the jailhouse is full. That's how you return the investment to your shareholders.
I think that Louisiana is one of the cheapest places to be in jail. And the average cost is $15,000 to $20,000 a year. Whereas each inmate in New York City, I have read, is about $60,000. a year.
If you have a school in the United States, the school would get from about $7,000 to $11,000 per year per student. And if it just says school on the outside, but if you take that same school or build a prison next door to it, or take that same school and erase the word school and put prison on it, now the government would give each student $40,000 a year.
So we're dealing with all of those. And there's and then they meet as associations, all of the for-profit prisons, and they meet with legislators, and they help to design laws to lock up young men and to keep them in jail longer. And so that doesn't come out of a vacuum, that comes out of design. And basically what you're really looking at is a corporate takeover of the country and indeed of the world, which renders everybody back to a condition of being enslaved in one way or another. You're either out there working for a corporation and you think that you're free, but you're really not free, or you're sitting in a jailhouse and you know you're not free.
Prohibited slavery for citizens in the United States, but we've also legitimized involuntary servitude as long as you have been duly convicted of a crime. So even within the Constitution of the U.S., you are a slave as long as you're in the criminal justice system.
We are far from being able to effectuate a change in that. And just to be able to mobilize after you experience that kind of brutality, police murder, to live in a virtual police state, that's what the Black and Latino communities are. It is enormously painful and difficult, and it certainly affects everything about how people live their lives and what they think the potential are, and how they are going to arise or rise above.
We have racial profiling all over the country with Ayanna Jones, I believe it was in Detroit, 7-year-old girl shot in the neck by a police officer in her sleep. We have Sean Bell, Oscar Grant, all these different cases occurring all across the country, so it can't be on an individual basis when you see a whole group of people being affected by this oppression and this racism continually. It has to be called systemic.
The reality is in the United States that currently 51% of Americans still say that they have anti-Black sentiments.
The policies are inherently racist. We have never seen in New York City, in Oakland, in Philadelphia, in Chicago, I've never seen in my lifetime a Black cop shoot a white kid. I can't name one incident in the history of since I've been alive and since I've been studying criminal justice criminology, I've never seen it. Does that mean if for some reason Black cops have more discretion and are more savvy about stopping a white kid and pulling out a gun? I clearly think they probably are, because they would know the repercussions if that happened, right? If Trayvon Martin were a white kid shot by a Black civilian, he would have been summarily arrested and probably would have never received bail. That's the reality of the United States.
Thank you.
as a result of the videotaping that I was doing, there was pushback. You know, there's always action, reaction, you know. And there was pushback by NYPD, and they arrested me in retaliation for the videotaping that I was doing. And they charged me with possession of a weapon, a knife that you can buy in any store, hardware store, 99-cent store, not just in New York, but in the country, you know, with absolutely nothing illegal about it. But they came out of my car with it in their hand like they had discovered plastic explosives on a United Airlines or something, right? And so they, but these were the same police that I had videotaped 2 months prior. And we had a conversation back and forth. They said, we know who you are, you know. So obviously they had already done some background investigation on me. And the people that they were, had pulled over and were doing this stop and frisk routine on, it was two young men, both of them had cars. They tore their cars apart, frisked them. And all the time they were shining flashlights in my face. Trying to obstruct me videotaping this. Everything is punishment in America's foreign policy as well as in its domestic policy. You know, everything is punishment. You know, somebody does something to America, we drop atomic bombs on them. You know, we institute regime change. You know, and presently Obama has a hit list. He's out there talking about, you know, killing people and dumping them in the ocean. You know, that's the American response, and it's insanity. And it has to change.
I think that we have to fight with the same weapons the U.S. government is fighting with. And no, I do not mean weapons of murder and mass destruction like drones, nuclear bombs, and things like that. But I'm talking about political and organizational weapons.
We have to organize ourselves. We have to become communities instead of neighborhoods. And we have to organize ourselves politically, economically, and socially. We have to become a caring community that looks on every member of our community as someone of value.
We can unite. I believe that if people understand, because I didn't know it, I really thought that, you know, I pledge allegiance every morning. You teach children something from the time they're 5 years old, all the way up until they're, you know, well, through your whole life. You go to a ball game, you reiterate it. And you teach something to a person all their lives, they believe it. I believed I was free. I believed I was valued. I believed that I had rights. And I can't find any government agency that will stand up for my rights.
Americans of every race and region and station who came here because you believe in what this country can be and because you want to help us get there.
We have a situation here in the United States where we have people who have been trained, again, as distinct from education, in places like Harvard and Princeton and Yale, who have taken tremendous strides to further the agenda of the ruling classes. People like Barack Obama, Susan Rice and Condoleezza Rice.
Have you ever saw the lady, Miss Rice, in the UN? Good God Almighty, she sounds like Netanyahu, tell the truth. I said, good God Almighty, that lady is horrible. And Eric Holder, he used to be the U.S. attorney here. He locked up blacks by the hundreds of thousands.
I never imagined as a child that I would see a time when the President of the United States would claim the legal right to kill or imprison American citizens without charge or trial, and more so that that person would be a black person?
First, we'd have to define what's a leader. Self-imposed leaders like Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton, who place themselves and who I would assume that the popular media machine has placed in front of us as our leaders? Is that what you're talking about?
Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, it's too many names. There's just countless numbers of them who claim to be a part of the civil rights movement. And what they do is they block spokespersons. We shouldn't be waiting for Fox News to tell us what's going on.
Until we address alternative forms of media, such as what you're doing today, and providing those alternative forms of media to African Americans so we're not just inundated with images that we see on BET or CNN or MSNBC.
I think we as black Americans are doing wonderful. I think that given the disadvantages that we've had, given the disadvantages that we're currently under, that it's amazing that we are where we are. And it's only through a testament to us as a people that we aren't crawled up in some corner whining.
To go through enslavement and still be a people that absolutely know how to laugh and dance, and you come into a room and folks start playing the dozens with you, don't even really know you, but they start messing with you, and everybody laughs about it. And I said, it's because that has been the tools of survival, that we laughed in the face of death, and we danced when folks tried to bound us.
Is there any hope for African American people? Yes, I think there is. I know that there are a lot of people like yourself, Randy, myself, that are not giving up.
Apathy is the greatest sin. That when you're quiet about abuses, then you only facilitate greater abuses.
I think the people have to stand up against the government, because the change will not come from the government.
But if you're worried about life, then you need to go on rock in a chair somewhere and get out the way. Especially today. I mean, they got drones. You know, we had to worry about helicopters. They got drones. You know, they don't need to put no informant in the room, because it's these cell phones.
We're born into this struggle, you know. I don't have a choice as to whether I'm born in China or India or wherever. I'm born in Harlem. I'm black. You know what I'm saying? I'm poor. And so the battle lines is already drawn out. Right? There's the regulators and the regulated. And I'm part of the regulated. And so for me, there's nothing but war. You know, that's my destiny. And surrender is not an option. So what do? We fight. You know, we fight to change this reality. Because whatever man creates, other men can change. I believe that.
There was a priest, Ernesto Cardenal, and he said, you know, it's, you finally won the revolution, what now? And Cardenal said, well, continue to push. And he said, but you won the revolution. He said, we won the revolution, but it's not the kingdom of God. It's all imperfect. The prophet pushes towards the perfection. Doesn't settle for that, which might be nice, but it still lies on this side of glory. We got to push towards perfection. Till everybody's liberated, till everybody's free, till everybody's included, till there's no 1% versus the 99%, but we're talking about 100%. That's where we got to push towards, and begin to create a new vision, a new paradigm for this country and for the world.